on the opposite side of the hall. I walked in there feeling a little stupid. Donna and Johnny were sitting in a corner of the dining room as quiet as two mice. They looked as though they were scared to death. I realized then how mean Mrs. Burke was. Donnie and Johnny were as noisy as 10 children when they were home, and they never stayed in one place. Mrs. Burke came in just as I finished putting on Johnny's diaper. She stood smiling at me for a while. Essie, are you planning to take on another job now that Linda Jean is moving? She asked. I just looked at her with my mouth wide open. She had purposely said, Linda Jean. I can use some help if you won't work, she finally said, still smiling. I was too stunned to answer. Well, you think about it, and let me know before you leave Linda Jean's today. I did think about her a lot the next few hours. She was a strange woman, and she puzzled me. I just couldn't make up my mind to work for her. However, when I got home and was again faced with a sick mother, crying babies, an unemployed stepfather, and a plate of dried beans, my mind was made up for me. I knew that I had to take that job. I had to help secure that plate of dry beans, if nothing else. I went to work for Mrs. Burke the following morning. I was so uneasy that first day at Mrs. Burke's. However, I felt better after becoming familiar with the rest of the household and making the discovery that Mrs. Burke was the only nasty person in there. Her mother, Mrs. Crosby, was a very nice old lady with long braids wrapped around her head. She thought I was a beautiful girl and took a keen interest in me from the start. Wayne, Mrs. Burke's son, was my same age and grade. He was very much like Linda Jean in the sense that he also treated me as his equal. It was hard for me to accept the fact that he and Linda Jean were Mrs. Burke's children. I didn't meet her eldest son, Dennis, who was her favorite. I didn't meet him, but I knew that if he was her favorite, he too must be evil with a negative attitude toward Negroes. Mr. Burke, her husband, was difficult to figure. He was very seldom home, and when he was, he hardly ever said anything. Mrs. Burke, an ex-school teacher, was a typical matriarch. She ruled her whole family and even tried to rule me. She had a certain way of doing everything in her house, from sweeping to setting a table. I guess all the maids she had had before catered to these little wishes of hers. But I had no intention of doing so, and I had my own little ways of resisting her rule. When I first ironed some shirts for her, she brought all 15 of them back for me to redo. Take out these cat faces, Essie. Wayne can't wear these shirts looking like this. I watched you do these, and I see you have no set way of ironing shirts. Let me show you how it's done. I stood back and watched her do one shirt. Then I went over all of the remaining 14. But the very next week I did the ironing, I did all the shirts my way, and Mrs. Burke watched me do them too. But this time, she didn't have me redo them. In fact, she didn't say anything. I had always used the front door when entering and leaving her house. The morning after that second ironing, I walked up on the front porch and discovered that the screen door was locked. "Who is it?" Mrs. Burke called as she heard me knocking. "It's me, Essie," I answered. "Use the back door, Essie. It's open," she yelled to me. The tone of her voice told me that she was again trying to subdue me. I went to the back door that morning, but the next morning I walked up on the front porch again and knocked at the front door. I knocked for what seemed like 10 minutes, and she still didn't answer. I didn't stop knocking, though. Finally, Mrs. Crosby came to the door and let me in. When I walked in, I noticed that, as usual, Mrs. Burke was occupying her favorite chair in the living room, which was the first room to the left as you entered the hall. I knew she had heard me knocking. That's all right, I thought. I will knock at the front door tomorrow morning again, and the day after that, too. When I knocked the next morning, Mrs. Crosby was standing in the hallway as if she was waiting for me. She let me in that morning and every morning at 7:30 after that. Soon, Mrs. Burke decided to let me do things my way. I would have quit had she not, and I think she knew it. She really had no complaints about my work, so she let me be. In a way, working for her was a challenge for me. She was the first one of her type I had run into. Part 2. High School. Chapter 10. Not only did I enter high school with a new name, but also with a completely new insight into the life of Negroes in Mississippi. I was now working for one of the meanest white women in town, and a week before school started, Emmett Till was killed. Up until his death, I had heard of Negroes found floating in a river or dead somewhere with their bodies riddled with bullets, but I didn't know the mystery behind these killings then. I remember once when I was only 7, I heard Mama and one of my aunts talking about some Negro who had been beaten to death. Just like them low-down skunks killed him, they will do the same to us, Mama had said. When I asked her who killed the man and why, she said, "An evil spirit killed him. You gotta be a good girl or it will kill you too." So since I was 7, I had lived in fear of that evil spirit. It took me 8 years to learn what that spirit was. I was coming from school the evening I heard about Emmett Till's death. There was a whole group of us, girls and boys, walking down the road headed home. A group of about 6 high school boys were walking a few paces ahead of me and several other girls. We were laughing and talking about something that had happened in school that day. However, the 6 boys in front of us weren't talking very loud. Usually they kept up so much noise. But today, they were just walking and talking among themselves. All of a sudden, they began to shout at each other. "Man, what in the hell do you mean?" "What I mean is, these goddamn white folks is gonna start some shit here. You just watch." "That boy wasn't but 14 years old, and they killed him. Now what can a 14-year-old boy do with a white woman? What if he did whistle at her? He might have thought the whore was pretty." "Look at all these white men here that's fucking over our women. Everybody knows it, too. And what's done about that? Look at how many white babies we got walking around in our neighborhoods. Their mamas ain't white either. That boy was from Chicago. Shit, everybody fuck everybody up there. He probably didn't even think of the bitch as white." What they were saying shocked me. I knew all of those boys, and I had never heard them talk like that. We walked on behind them for a while, listening. Questions about who was killed, where, and why started running through my mind. I walked up to one of the boys. "Eddie, what boy was killed?" "Moody, where have you been?" he asked me. "Everybody talking about that 14-year-old boy who was killed in Greenwood by some white men. You don't know nothing that's going on besides what's in them books of yours, huh?" Standing there before the rest of the girls, I felt so stupid. It was then that I realized I really didn't know what was going on all around me. It wasn't that I was dumb. It was just that ever since I was 9, I'd had to work after school and do my lessons on lunch hour. I never had time to learn anything, to hang around with people my own age. And you never were told anything by adults. That evening, when I stopped off at the house on my way to Mrs. Burke's, Mama was singing. Any other day, she would have been yelling at Adeline and Junior them to take off their school clothes. I wondered if she knew about Emmett Till. The way she was singing, she had something on her mind, and it wasn't pleasant either. I got a shoe. You got a shoe. All of God's children got shoes. When I get to heaven, I'm gonna put on my shoes and gonna tromp all over God's heaven. When I get to heaven, I'm gonna put on my shoes and gonna walk all over God's heaven. Mama was dishing up beans like she didn't know anyone was home. Adeline, Junior, and James had just thrown their books down and sat themselves at the table. I didn't usually eat before I went to work, but I wanted to ask Mama about Emmett Till, so I ate and thought of some way of asking her. "These beans are some good, Mama," I said, trying to sense her mood. "Why is you eating anyway? You gonna be late for work. You know how Miss Burke is," she said to me. "I don't have much to do this evening. I can get it done before I leave work," I said. The conversation stopped after that. Then Mama started humming that song again. "When I get to heaven, I'm gonna put on my shoes and gonna tromp all over God's heaven." She put a plate on the floor for Jenny Ann and Jerry.
"Jenny Ann, you and Jerry sit down here and eat and don't put beans all over this floor."
Ralph, the baby, started crying, and she went in the bedroom to give him his bottle. I got up and followed her.
"Mama, did you hear about that 14-year-old Negro boy who was killed a little over a week ago by some white men?" I asked her.
"Where did you hear that?"
she said angrily.
"Boy, everybody really thinks I am dumb or deaf or something. I heard Eddie them talking about it this evening coming from school."
"Eddie them better watch how they go around here talking. These white folks get a hold of it, they gonna be in trouble," she said.
"What are they gonna be in trouble about, Mama? People got a right to talk, ain't they?"
"You go on to work before you is late. And don't you let on like you know nothing about that boy being killed before Miss Burke them. Just do your work like you don't know nothing," she said.
"That boy's a lot better off in heaven than he is here," she continued, and then started singing again.
On my way to Mrs. Burke's that evening, Mama's words kept running through my mind.
"Just do your work like you don't know nothing."
"Why is Mama acting so scared?" I thought. "And what if Miss Burke knew we knew? Why must I pretend I don't know? Why are these people killing Negroes? What did Emmett Till do besides whistle at that woman?"
By the time I got to work, I had worked my nerves up some. I was shaking as I walked up on the porch.
"Do your work like you don't know nothing."
But once I got inside, I couldn't have acted normal if Miss Burke were paying me to be myself. I was so nervous, I spent most of the evening avoiding them, going about the house dusting and sweeping. Everything went along fairly well until dinner was served.
"Don, Wayne, and Mama, y'all come on to dinner. Essie, you can wash up the pots and dishes in the sink now. Then after dinner, you won't have as many," Mrs. Burke called to me.
If I had the power to mysteriously disappear at that moment, I would have. They used the breakfast table in the kitchen for most of their meals. The dining room was only used for Sunday dinner or when they had company. I wish they had company tonight so they could eat in the dining room while I was at the kitchen sink.
"I forgot the bread," Mrs. Burke said when they were all seated. "Essie, will you cut it and put it on the table for me?"
I took the cornbread, cut it in squares, and put it on a small round dish. Just as I was about to set it on the table, Wayne yelled at the cat. I dropped the plate, and the bread went all over the floor.
"Never mind, Essie,"
Mrs. Burke said angrily as she got up and got some white bread from the bread box. I didn't say anything. I picked up the cornbread from around the table and went back to the dishes. As soon as I got to the sink, I dropped a saucer on the floor and broke it. Didn't anyone say a word until I had picked up the pieces.
"Essie, I bought some new cleanser today. It's setting on the bathroom shelf. See if it will remove the stains in the tub," Mrs. Burke said.
I went to the bathroom to clean the tub,
By the time I got through with it, it was snow white. I spent a whole hour scrubbing it. I had removed the stains in no time, but I kept scrubbing until they finished dinner. When they had finished and gone into the living room as usual to watch TV, Mrs. Burke called me to eat. I took a clean plate out of the cabinet and sat down. Just as I was putting the first forkful of food in my mouth, Mrs. Burke entered the kitchen. "Essie, did you hear about that 14-year-old boy who was killed in Greenwood?" she asked me, sitting down in one of the chairs opposite me.
"No, I didn't hear that," I answered,
almost choking on the food. "Do you know why he was killed?" she asked, and I didn't answer. "He was killed because he got out of his place with a white woman. A boy from Mississippi would have known better than that. This boy was from Chicago. Negroes up north have no respect for people. They think they can get away with anything. He just came to Mississippi and put a whole lot of notions in the boys' heads here and stirred up a lot of trouble," she said passionately.
"How old are you, Essie?"
she asked me after a pause.
14.
I will soon be 15, though," I said. "See, that boy was just 14, too. It's a shame he had to die so soon." She was so red in the face, she looked as if she was on fire. When she left the kitchen, I sat there with my mouth open and my food untouched. I couldn't have eaten now if I was starving. "Just do your work like you don't know nothing," ran through my mind again, and I began washing the dishes. I went home shaking like a leaf on a tree. For the first time out of all her trying, Mrs. Burke had made me feel like rotten garbage. Many times she had tried to instill fear within me and subdue me and had given up. But when she talked about Emmett Till, there was something in her voice that sent chills and fear all over me. Before Emmett Till's murder, I had known the fear of hunger, hell, and the devil. But now there was a new fear known to me, the fear of being killed just because I was black. This was the worst of my fears. I knew once I got food, the fear of starving to death would leave. I also was told that if I were a good girl, I wouldn't have to fear the devil or hell. But I didn't know what one had to do or not do as a Negro not to be killed. Probably just being a Negro, period, was enough, I thought. A few days later, I went to work, and Mrs. Burke had about 8 women over for tea. They were all sitting around in the living room when I got there. She told me she was having a guild meeting and asked me to help her serve the cookies and tea. After helping her, I started cleaning the house. I always swept the hallway and porch first. As I was sweeping the hall, I could hear them talking. When I heard the word nigger, I stopped sweeping and listened. Mrs. Burke must have sensed this because she suddenly came to the door. "Essie, finish the hall and clean the bathroom," she said hesitantly. "Then you can go for today. I am not making dinner tonight." Then she went back in the living room with the rest of the ladies. Before she interrupted my listening, I had picked up the words NAACP and that organization. Because they were talking about niggers, I knew NAACP had something to do with Negroes. All that night I kept wondering, what could that NAACP mean? Later, when I was sitting in the kitchen at home doing my lessons, I decided to ask Mama. It was about 12:30. Everyone was in bed but me. When Mama came in to put some milk in Ralph's bottle, I said, "Mama, what do NAACP mean?" "Where did you get that from?" she asked me, spilling milk all over the floor.
"Mrs. Burke had a meeting tonight."
"What kind of meeting?" she asked, cutting me off.
I don't know. She had some women over. She said it was a guild meeting, I said.
A guild meeting, she repeated.
Yes, they were talking about Negroes, and I heard some woman say, that NAACP, and another, that organization, meaning the same thing.
What else did they say?
She asked me. That's all I heard. Mrs. Burke must have thought I was listening, so she told me to clean the bathroom and leave.
Don't you ever mention that word around Mrs. Burke or no other white person, you hear? Finish your lesson and cut that light out and go to bed,
Mama said angrily and left the kitchen.
With a mama like that, you'll never learn anything, I thought as I got into bed. All night long, I thought about Emmett Till and the NAACP. I even got up to look up NAACP in my little concise dictionary, but I didn't find it. The next day at school, I decided to ask my homeroom teacher, Mrs. Rice, the meaning of NAACP. When the bell sounded for lunch, I remained in my seat as the other students left the room.
Are you going to spend your lunch hour studying again today, Moody? Mrs. Rice asked me.
Can I ask you a question, Mrs. Rice?
I asked her.
You may ask me a question, yes, but I don't know if you can or not, she said.
What does the word NAACP mean? I asked.
Why do you want to know?
The lady I worked for had a meeting, and I overheard the word mentioned.
What else did you hear?
Nothing. I didn't know what NAACP meant, that's all.
I felt like I was on the witness stand or something.
Well, next time your boss has another meeting, you listen more carefully.
NAACP is a Negro organization that was established a long time ago to help Negroes gain a few basic rights, she said.
What's it got to do with the Emmett Till murder? I asked.
They are trying to get a conviction in Emmett Till's case. You see, the NAACP is trying to do a lot for the Negroes and get the right to vote for Negroes in the South. I shouldn't be telling you all this, and don't you dare breathe a word of what I said. It could cost me my job if word got out I was teaching my students such. I gotta go to lunch, and you should go outside too because it's nice and sunny out today, she said, leaving the room.
We'll talk more when I have time.
About a week later, Mrs. Rice had me over for Sunday dinner, and I spent about 5 hours with her. Within that time, I digested a good meal and accumulated a whole new pool of knowledge about Negroes being butchered and slaughtered by whites in the South. After Mrs. Rice had told me all this, I felt like the lowest animal on earth, at least when other animals, hogs, cows, etc., were killed by man, they were used as food. But when man was butchered or killed by man, in the case of Negroes by whites, they were left lying on a road or found floating in a river or something. Mrs. Rice got to be something like a mother to me. She told me anything I wanted to know and made me promise that I would keep all this information she was passing on to me to myself. She said she couldn't, rather didn't, want to talk about these things to the other teachers, that they would tell Mr. Willis and she would be fired. At the end of that year, she was fired. I never found out why. I haven't seen her since then. Chapter 11. I was 15 years old when I began to hate people. I hated the white men who murdered Emmett Till, and I hated all the other whites who were responsible for the countless murders Mrs. Rice had told me about, and those I vaguely remembered from childhood. But I also hated Negroes. I hated them for not standing up and doing something about the murders. In fact, I think I had a stronger resentment toward Negroes for letting the whites kill them than toward the whites. Anyway, It was at this stage in my life that I began to look upon Negro men as cowards. I could not respect them for smiling in a white man's face, addressing him as Mr. So-and-so, saying yes, sir, and no, sir, when after they were home, behind closed doors, that same white man was a son of a bitch, a bastard, or any other name more suitable than Mr. Emmett Till's murder provoked a lot of anger and excitement among whites in Centerville. Now, just about every evening when I got to work, Mrs. Burke had to attend a guild meeting. She had more women coming over now than ever. She and her friends had organized canvassing teams and a telephone campaign to solicit for new members. Within a couple of months, most of the whites in Centerville were taking part in the guild. The meetings were initially held in the various houses. There were lawn parties and church gatherings. Then, when it began to get cold, they were held in the high school auditorium. After the guild had organized about two-thirds of the whites in Centerville, all kinds of happenings were unveiled. The talk was on. White housewives began firing their maids and scolding their husbands, and the Negro communities were full of whispered gossip. The most talked-about subject was a love affair Mr. Fox, the deputy sheriff, and one of my classmates were carrying on. Bess was one of the oldest girls in my class. She was a shapely, high brown girl of about 17. She did general housekeeping and nursing for Fox and his wife. It was general policy that most young white couples in Centerville hired only older Negro women as helpers. However, when there were two or more children in the family, it was more advantageous to hire a young Negro girl. That way, they always had someone to babysit when there was a need for a babysitter. My job with Linda Jean had been this kind. I kept Donna and Johnny on Sundays and babysat at night when they needed me. Even though the teenage Negro girls were more desirable for such jobs, very few, if any, were trusted in the homes of the young couples. The young white housewife didn't dare leave one alone in the house with her loyal and obedient husband. She was afraid that the Negro girl would seduce him, never the contrary. There had been whispering in the Negro communities about Bess and Fox for some time. Just about every young white man in Centerville had a Negro lover. Therefore, Fox, even though he was the deputy sheriff, wasn't doing anything worse than the rest of the men. At least, that's the way the Negroes looked at the situation. Fox wasn't anyone special to them. But the whites didn't see it that way. The sheriff and all of his deputies were, in the eyes of their white compatriots, honorable men. And these honorable men were not put into office because they loved Negroes. So when the white community caught on about Fox and Bess, naturally, they were out to expose the affair. Such exposure would discourage other officers from similar misbehavior. Mrs. Fox was completely devoted to her husband. She, too, thought he was an honest man, and she was willing to do anything that would prove him innocent. Soon, a scheme was underway. Mrs. Fox was to leave home every so often. It had been reported that every time she was out and Bess was left there alone, Fox found his way home for one reason or another. Mrs. Fox left home purposely a couple of times while the neighbors kept watch. They confirmed the report that Fox would always return home. So one day, Mrs. Fox decided to take the children and visit her mother, but she only went as far as the house next door. Bess was to come and give the house a thorough cleaning on the same day. Mrs. Fox waited almost an hour at her neighbor's and nothing happened. It was said she was ready to go home and apologize to Bess and call her husband and do likewise. But just as she was about to do so, Fox drove up and went inside. She waited about 30 minutes more, then went home. When she walked into her bedroom, there they were, her husband and Bess, lying in her bed all curled up together. Poor Bess was so frightened that she ran out of the house clothed only in her slip with her panties in her hands. She never set foot in Mrs. Fox's house again. Neither did she return to school afterward. She took a job in the quarters where we lived, in a Negro cafe. It was said that she didn't need the job, though, because after her embarrassing episode with Fox, her reputation was beyond repair, and he felt obligated to take care of her. Last I heard of Bess, she was still in Centerville, wearing fine clothes and carrying on as usual. Fox is no longer deputy, I understand, but he and his wife are still together. It appeared after a while that the much-talked-about maids' raids were only a means of diverting attention from what was really taking place in those guild meetings. In the midst of all the talk about what white man was screwing which Negro woman, new gossip emerged about what Negro man was screwing which white woman. This gossip created so much tension, every Negro man in Centerville became afraid to walk the streets. They knew too well that they would not get off as easily as the white man who was caught screwing a Negro woman. They had only to look at a white woman and be hanged for it. Emmett Till's murder had proved it was a crime, punishable by death, for a Negro man to even whistle at a white woman in Mississippi. I had never heard of a single affair in Centerville between a Negro man and a white woman. It was almost impossible for such an affair to take place. Negro men did not have access to white women, whereas almost every white man in town had a Negro woman in his kitchen or nursing his babies. The tension lasted for about a month before anything happened. Then, one day, a rumor was spread throughout town that a Negro had been making telephone calls to a white operator and threatening to molest her. It was also said that the calls had been traced to a certain phone that was now under watch. Next thing we heard in the Negro community was that they had caught and nearly beaten to death a boy who, they said, had made the calls to the white operator. All the Negroes went around saying, "Y'all know that boy didn't do that." That boy was my classmate, Jerry. A few months later, I got a chance to talk to him, and he told me what happened. He said he had used the telephone at Billups and Phillips service station and was on his way home when Sheriff Ed Cassidy came along in his pickup truck. "Hey, buddy," Cassidy called. "You on your way home?" "Yes," Jerry answered. "Jump in. I'm going your way. I'll give you a lift." Then Jerry told me that when they got out there by the scales where the big trucks weigh at the old camp intersection, Cassidy let him out, telling him that he had forgotten something in town and had to go back and pick it up. At that point, Jerry told me, he didn't suspect anything. He just got out of the truck and told Cassidy thanks. But as soon as the sheriff pulled away, a car came along and stopped. There were four men in it. A deep voice ordered Jerry to get into the car. When he saw that two of the men were Jim Dixon and Nat Withers, whom he had often seen hanging around town with Cassidy, he started to run. But the two in the back jumped out and grabbed him. They forced him into the car and drove out into the camp area. When they got about 5 miles out, they turned down a little dark dirt road, heavily shaded with trees. They pushed Jerry out of the car onto the ground. He got up and dashed into the woods, but they caught up with him and dragged him farther into the woods. Then they tied him to a tree and beat him with a big, thick leather strap and a piece of hose pipe. I asked him if they told him why they were beating him. "No, not at first," Jerry said. "But when I started screaming and crying and asking them why they were beating me, Dixon told me I was trying to be smart, and they just kept on beating me. Then one of the men I didn't know asked me, 'Did you make that phone call, boy?' I said no. I think he kinda believed me 'cause he stopped beating me, but the others didn't.
The rest of them beat me until I passed out. When I came out of it, I was lying on the ground, untied, naked, and bleeding. I tried to get up, but I was hurting all over, and it was hard to move. Finally, I got my clothes on that them son of a bitches had tore off of me, and I made it out to the main highway, but I fainted again. When I woke up, I was home in bed. Daddy them was scared to take me to the hospital in Centerville. I didn't even see a doctor cause they were scared to take me to them white doctors. Wasn't any bones or anything broken. I was swollen all over, though, and you can see I still have bruises and cuts from the strap, but otherwise I guess I'm okay. When I asked him whether they were going to do anything about it, he said that his daddy had gotten a white lawyer from Baton Rouge. But after the lawyer pried around in Centerville for a few days, he suddenly disappeared. Jerry's beating shook up all the Negroes in town, but the most shocking and unjust crime of all occurred a few months later, about 2 weeks before school ended. One night, about 1 o'clock, I was awakened by what I thought was a terrible nightmare. It was an empty dream that consisted only of hollering and screaming voices. It seemed as though I was in an empty valley screaming, and the sounds of my voice were reflected in a million echoes that was so loud I was being lifted in midair by the sound waves. I found myself standing trembling in the middle of the floor, reaching for the light string. Then I saw Mama running to the kitchen in her nightgown. "Mama! Mama! What's all them voices? Where are all those people? What's happening?" "I don't know," she said, coming to my bedroom door. "Listen! Listen!" I said, almost screaming. "Stop all that loud talking before you wake up the rest of them chaps. It must be a house on fire or something, 'cause of all the screaming. Somebody must be hurt in it, or something, too. Ray is getting the car. We're gonna go see what it is," she said, and headed for the back door. "You going in your gown?" I asked her. "We ain't gonna get out of the car. Come on, you can go," she said, "but don't slam the door and wake them chaps up." I followed her out of the back door in my pajamas. Raymond was just backing the car out of the driveway. When we turned the corner leaving the quarters, Raymond drove slowly alongside hundreds of people running down the road. They were all headed in the direction of the blaze that reddened the sky. The crowd of people began to swell until driving was utterly impossible. Finally, the long line of cars stopped. We were about 2 blocks away from the burning house now. The air was so hot that water was running down the faces of the people who ran past the car. The burning house was on the rock road, leading to the school, adjacent to the street we stopped on. So we couldn't tell which house it was. From where we sat, it seemed as though it could have been 2 or 3 of them burning. I knew every Negro living in the houses that lined that rock road. I passed them every day on my way to and from school. I sat there in my pajamas, wishing I had thrown on a dress or something so I could get out of the car. "Ray, ask somebody who house it is," Mama said to Raymond. "Hi. Excuse me." Raymond leaned out of the car and spoke to a Negro man. "Do you know who house is on fire?" "I heard it was the Taplin family. They say the whole family is still in the house. Look like they are done for, so they say." Didn't any one of us say anything after that. We just sat in the car silently. I couldn't believe what the man had just said. A whole family burned to death. Impossible, I thought. "What you think happened, Ray?" Mama finally said to Raymond. "I don't know. You never can tell," Raymond said. "It seems mighty strange, though." Soon people started walking back down the road. The screams and hollering had stopped. People were almost whispering now. They were all Negroes, although I was almost sure I had seen some white faces pass before. "I guess not," I thought,
sitting there sick inside. Some of the ladies passing the car had tears running down their faces as they whispered to each other.
"Didn't you smell that gasoline?"
I heard a lady who lived in the quarters say. "That house didn't just catch on fire. And just think them bastards burned up a whole family," another lady said. Then they were quiet again. Soon their husbands neared the car.
"Hey, Jones,"
Raymond said to one of the men.
"How many was killed?"
"About 8 or 9 of them, Ray. They say the old lady and one of the children got out. I didn't see her nowhere, though."
"You think the house was set on fire?"
Raymond asked.
"It sure looks like it, Ray. It burned down like nothing. When I got out there, that house was burning on every side. If it had started on the inside of the house at some one place, then it wouldn't burn down like it did. All the walls fell in together. Too many strange things are happening round here these days."
Now most of the people and cars were gone. Raymond drove up to the Little Rock Road and parked. I almost vomited when I caught a whiff of the odor of burned bodies mixed with the gasoline. The wooden frame house had been burned to ashes. All that was left were some iron bedposts and springs, a blackened refrigerator, a stove, and some kitchen equipment. We sat in the car for about an hour, silently looking at this debris and the ashes that covered the 9 charcoal-burned bodies. 100 or more also stood around, Negroes from the neighborhood in their pajamas, nightgowns, and housecoats, and even a few whites with their eyes fixed on that dreadful scene. I shall never forget the expressions on the faces of the Negroes. There was almost unanimous hopelessness in them. The still, sad faces watched the smoke rising from the remains until the smoke died down to practically nothing. There was something strange about that smoke. It was the thickest and blackest smoke I had ever seen. Raymond finally drove away, but it was impossible for him to take me away from that nightmare. Those screams, those faces, that smoke would never leave me. The next day, I took the long roundabout way to school. I didn't want to go by the scene that was so fixed in my mind. I tried to convince myself that nothing had happened in the night. And I wanted so much to believe that, to believe anything but the dream itself. However, at school, everybody was talking about it. All during each class, there was whispering from student to student. Hadn't many of my classmates witnessed the burning last night? I wish they had. If so, they wouldn't be talking so much, I thought, because I had seen it and I couldn't talk about it. I just couldn't. I was so glad when the bell sounded for the lunch hour. I picked up my books and headed home. I couldn't endure another minute of that torture. I was in such a hurry to get away from the talk at school, I forgot to take the roundabout way home. Before I realized it, I was standing there where the Taplins' house had been. It looked quite different by day than it had at night. The ashes and junk had been scattered as if someone had looked for the remains of the bodies. The heavy black smoke had disappeared completely. But I stood there, looking at the spot where I had seen it rising, and I saw it again, slowly drifting away, disappearing before my eyes. I tore myself away and ran almost all the way home. When I walked in the house, Mama didn't even ask me why I came home. She just looked at me. And for the first time, I realized she understood what was going on within me, or was trying to anyway. I took 2 aspirins and went to bed. I stayed there all afternoon. When it was time for me to go to work after school, Mama didn't come in. She must have known I wasn't in the mood for Mrs. Burke that evening. I wasn't in the mood for anything. I was just there inside of myself, inflicting pain with every thought that ran through my mind. That night, Centerville was like a ghost town. It was so quiet and still. The quietness almost drove me crazy. It was too quiet for sleeping that night, yet it was too restless for dreams and too dry for weeping. A few days later, it was reported that the fire had started from the kerosene lamp used by Mrs. Taplin as a light for the new baby. Nobody bought that story. At least none of those who witnessed that fire and smelled all that gasoline. They were sure that more than a lampful of kerosene caused that house to burn that fast. There was so much doubt and dissension about the Taplin burning that finally FBI agents arrived on the scene and quietly conducted an investigation. But as usual in this sort of case, the investigation was dropped as soon as public interest died down. Months later, the story behind the burning was whispered throughout the Negro community. Some of the Taplin's neighbors who had been questioned put their scraps of information together and came up with an answer that made sense. Living next door to the Taplin family was a Mr. Banks, a high yellow mulatto man of much wealth. He was a bachelor with land and cattle galore. He had for some time discreetly taken care of a white woman, the mother of three, whose husband had deserted her, leaving her to care for the children the best way she knew how. She lived in a bottom where a few other poor whites lived. The Guild, during one of its investigations, discovered the children at home alone one night, and many other nights after that. Naturally, they wondered where the mother was spending her nights. A few days' observation of the bottom proved she was leaving home after putting the children to bed and being picked up by Mr. Banks in inconspicuous places. When the Taplin family was burned, Mr. Banks escaped his punishment. Very soon afterward, he locked his house and disappeared, and so did the white lady from the bottom. I could barely wait until school was out. I was so sick of Centerville. I made up my mind to tell Mama I had to get away, if only for the summer. I had thought of going to Baton Rouge to live with my Uncle Ed, who was now married and living there with his family. A few days before school ended, I sat in the midst of about six of my classmates who insisted on discussing the Taplin family. By the time I got home, my nerves were in shreds from thinking of some of the things they had said. I put my books down, took two aspirins, and got into bed. I didn't think I could go to work that evening because I was too nervous to be around Mrs. Burke. I had not been myself at work since the Emmett Till murder, especially after the way Mrs. Burke had talked to me about the Taplin family. But she had become more observant of my reactions. "What's wrong with you? Is you sick?" Mama asked me. I didn't answer her. "Take your shoes off that spread. You better get up and go to work. Mrs. Burke gonna fire you." "I got a headache and I don't feel like going," I said. "What's wrong with you? Getting so many headaches around here?" I decided not to wait any longer to tell Mama my plan. "Mama, I am gonna write Ed and see can I stay with him this summer and get a job in Baton Rouge. I am just tired of working for Mrs. Burke for $1 a day. I can make $5 a day in Baton Rouge, and I make only $6 a week here." "Ed, them ain't got enough room for you to live with them. Take your shoes off," Mama said, and left me lying in bed. As soon as she left, I got up and wrote my letter. About 5 days later, I received an answer from Ed. He said I was welcome, so I started packing to leave the next day. Mama looked at me as if she didn't want me to go, but she knew better than to ask me. I was 15 years old and leaving home for the first time. I wasn't even sure I could get a job at that age, but I had to go anyway, if only to breathe a slightly different atmosphere. I was choking to death in Centerville. I couldn't go on working for Mrs. Burke, pretending I was dumb and innocent, pretending I didn't know what was going on in all her Guild meetings, or about Jerry's beating, or about the Taplin burning and everything else that was going on. I was sick of pretending, sick of selling my feelings for $1 a day. Chapter 12. When I got off Greyhound in Baton Rouge, Ed was waiting for me. I hadn't seen him in a long time. He looked different, but he hadn't changed. He was still my favorite uncle and best-liked relative. Bertha, his wife, wasn't an easy person to deal with, though. She didn't have an extra bedroom, so I had to sleep in the living room. Her sofa was new, and she didn't really want me to sleep on it. I thought of going back home the very next day, but I told myself, if I put up with Mrs. Burke for over a year, I sure can put up with Bertha for 3 months. I just won't eat much of their food, and I'll stay out of her way as much as possible. Within 3 days, I had found a job, or rather, a job found me. Mrs. Jetson, a lady Bertha had once worked for, stopped in to see if Bertha would keep her children on the weekend. But Bertha had another job now. She worked 6 days a week in a restaurant. She suggested that Mrs. Jetson hire me instead. The sooner I get some money coming in, the better, I thought. So I took the job. However, that Sunday night when Mrs. Jetson paid me $6 for 2 days' work, I was some disappointed. When she asked me if I would consider working for her throughout the summer, I told her I would have to think about it. Coming from work that evening, I walked the 3 blocks back to Ed's in what seemed like 1 minute flat. As soon as I stepped into the living room where Ed and Bertha were watching TV, I said, "Bertha, why didn't you tell me she just paid $3 a day? I thought you got paid $5 a day here." "Look, Essie Mae, that woman is poor. Only the rich whites here pay $5 a day for housework. You don't have to keep the job. You can just work there until you find something better to do." "I was talking to my boss today," Ed said. "His wife is going to try and find something for you, but you keep that job until you get something else." I called up Mrs. Jetson the next day and told her I would take the job for the summer. I would be making $18 a week. I went to bed that night thinking that within 2 weeks, I would have another job. Mrs. Jetson worked in one of the big shoe stores on 3rd Avenue. Her husband was a construction worker. I didn't realize how poor they were until that Saturday, the end of my first week's work. I had finished everything and was watching TV with her 2 sons when she came home that evening. "I'm going when this story is over, Mrs. Jetson," I said, indicating I was waiting for my money. "Essie, I am going to have to give you a check Saturday of next week. I won't be able to make any deposits until then." I stood there looking and feeling like a stupid fool. I didn't say anything, though. I just left. "I will not go back there Monday for nothing," I thought as I went to bed. But by Monday, I'd changed my mind. I knew if I didn't go back, I would never get my money. The next Saturday, I walked up on the porch and found the house locked. I was shocked. After noticing the curtains had been removed from the front window, I looked inside and saw that the house was empty. I didn't believe it. I stood there looking in that window for about 30 minutes. Then I knocked on the door of the lady who lived in the next house. "Excuse me, please. I just noticed that Mrs. Jetson moved last night. Did she leave any money with you for me?" I asked her. "Money? They don't have any money. They were going to be thrown out of the house today. That's why they left last night. She didn't pay you?" the lady asked. "No, and she owes me for 2 weeks' work." "Why don't you call her at the store on Monday?" she suggested. "That's pretty thoughtless of her to do such a thing." On Monday, I did call the shoe store and was told Mrs. Jetson had quit on Friday. I had never before felt so gypped in all my life. Out of all the women I had worked for, this woman was the worst, even worse than Mrs. Burke. The following week, I went to see a girl I had once gone to school with who was also living with her uncle in Baton Rouge. Susie was working in a restaurant. She had promised me that she would let me know when there was an opening there, but that evening she told me bluntly, "Essie Mae, they ain't hired nobody at the restaurant in a long time, and they look like they ain't gonna be hiring nobody soon. Jobs are so hard to find, people just don't quit so fast now." I went back to Ed's and packed up my suitcase. I would have gone back to Centerville that night, but Ed wouldn't let me leave until next morning. I overslept and missed the 9 o'clock bus. The only other bus going to Centerville was at 4:30 that afternoon, so I bought my ticket with the $5 Ed had given me and put my suitcase in the locker and went back to Ed's to wait. As soon as I walked in, Bertha told me that Susie had called because she'd found a job for me. I called Susie that night. She told me that they needed someone right away, and she asked me to go with her the next morning for the interview. I made up my mind that I could get that job. I'll pass the interview, I told myself. I know I can. But I left my suitcase at the bus station in the locker, just in case. When I met Susie, I was wearing bangs and a ponytail and looked more like 12 than 15. She balled my hair up on my head and made me put on more powder and lipstick. Now you tell them you are 18 or 19, 'cause they won't hire you if they know you are 15. And tell them you finished school, too, she said to me as we got off the bus together. The only thing Susie didn't warn me about was to lie about my Social Security card. I didn't even know what Social Security was at the time. Mississippi Negroes never made enough money to have any taken out for hard times. Times were always hard, and I guess white folks didn't think they would live long enough to enjoy it. Anyway, I told the manager of Orso's department store that I'd left my Social Security card at home in another purse. They needed someone so badly that they took me on, and I started work that very same day. As soon as my lunch break came, I ran next door to the restaurant to ask Susie about a Social Security card. She said we could pick one up on our way home that evening. We spent an hour together walking around the neighborhood. Susie pointed out several other businesses the Orsos owned. Among them were Orso Hardware, Restaurant, Gas Station, Grocery, and Tasty Freeze. And one of the Orsos was president of the American Bank. They owned that whole section of Plank Road. They were the richest people I had ever heard of. One of them lived in a mansion almost 2 blocks long. All the white folks in Centerville put together didn't have as much as the Orso family. I kept thinking of how unfair it was for any one set of people to have so much. My job consisted of cleaning the showcase glass, pressing wrinkles out of new dresses, helping with display windows, and sometimes sweeping. There were two of us employed in the same capacity. The other lady was a middle-aged Negro woman who worked part-time. She told me that she had worked for the Orsos for about 10 years and how nice and rich they were. We were both paid $24 a week. I didn't consider that salary just at all. I felt that as rich as they were, they could have afforded more, much more. In no time at all, I was well liked by most of the Orso family. They considered me a pretty little sweet colored girl. I was very shapely, with nice long legs. The young women in the Orso family were always telling me how they envied my shape and asking me how I kept so nice and slim. If you were 15, you'd look slimmer too, I thought. The lady working with me had been considered the Orso's favorite Negro before me. Within 2 weeks, she was almost completely out of the picture. I was now getting all of their attention. One day, when she and I were out in the ironing room pressing dresses, she became extremely confidential with me. She told me all about her family, her ex-husband, etc. She and I even spent our lunch hour together. We had a beautiful time. I was so overcome by how nice she was to me that I told her all about myself, that I was only 15 and hadn't finished high school, that I was from Mississippi, and that I only had 1 month to work there. When I came to work the next morning, I was told the manager was waiting in his office for me. He was sitting at his desk when I walked into his office. The only thing he said was, "Here is your check, Ann. We can't use you anymore. Thanks. We liked you." I stood there wondering what had I done. I wanted so badly to ask him, but the look on his face told me that it was best that I just leave. So I did. Walking out of the door, I saw my confidential friend who had shared the work with me. I was about to walk up to her and say goodbye when she turned her head. Then I knew what I had done wrong. I got off Greyhound in Centerville with $65 in my pocket and new school clothes. Walking home swinging my suitcase, I began to think that the experience hadn't been so bad after all. I got so wrapped up in thinking about Baton Rouge that I forgot I was back in Centerville until I ran into Doris, one of my classmates.
"Moody, where you been? You certainly disappeared some fast after school. Someone said you were in New Orleans."
"I went to Baton Rouge and lived with Ed and got a job. What's been going on here?" I asked her.
"Nothing, really. They ran Benty and Mrs. Rosetta them out of town," she said.
"For what?" I asked.
"They claim Benty was screwing that little poor white girl who lived down in that bottom," she said.
"The girl living in that bottom where that white woman with them three children lived?" I asked her.
"What white woman with three children?" she asked.
"The one Mr. Banks was supposed to be taking care of. The one who left town after the Taplin burning."
"Yes, that's the girl. The one living next to where that woman lived," Doris said.
"You know Benty wouldn't have nothing to do with that trash," I said.
"They say he did. Anyway, Benty them have moved now."
"Where?" I asked.
"To Woodville, so they say. Benty was kin to you, wasn't he?"
"Yes, he's my cousin. Not close, though."
Suddenly, I was trembling. "I better get on home," I managed to say. "Mama them don't even know I'm coming."
I felt as bad as if I had never gone to Baton Rouge for the summer. "Before I get home," I thought, "I'll have a nervous breakdown in the street. I'll surely get sick if anything like the Taplin burning happens this year. I'll just crack up if I have to push anything else into the back of my mind."
I was still shaking as I walked up on the porch. Jenny Ann was playing there.
"Essie May done come home," she cried.
She went running into the kitchen where Mama, Raymond, and the rest of them were sitting, while I went to my room to drop my suitcase and try to pull myself together.
"Look at you," Mama said when I walked in the kitchen. "As skinny as a stick. Didn't Bertha and Ed feed you?"
"Sho, I had plenty to eat," I said.
"Then how come you lost all that weight?" she asked.
"I don't know. I just lost weight, that's all. I met Doris on my way home, and she told me they ran Mrs. Rosetta and Benty them out of town."
Raymond got up and walked out of the kitchen at that point. When I looked at Mama, she dropped her head. Then I looked at Adeline, James, Junior, Jenny Ann, and Jerry. They seemed a little strange to me, too, and I stood there trying to figure out just what was strange about them. Why had Raymond walked out? Why wouldn't Mama look at me?
I didn't say anything more to anyone. I walked out of the kitchen, went to my bedroom, and flung myself on the bed. After a while, Mama came in.
"Take your shoes off that spread," she said angrily.
"What's wrong with everybody? What's wrong with Raymond?" I asked her as I kicked off my shoes.
"Ain't nothing wrong with Ray. What's wrong with you? Before you get in the house, you start worrying me about who got run out of town. Why is you so interested in things like that?"
"Why can't I ask about Benty them? They all kin to us, ain't they? What's wrong with people talking? What's wrong with people? Negroes are being killed, beaten up, run out of town by these white folks and everything. But Negroes can't even talk about it. I should have stayed in Baton Rouge."
Mama didn't say a word after that. She just went away, looking hurt. After she left, I began to think of what Mrs. Rice told me once when I was talking to her about the NAACP.
"You gotta find something to do, Essie, that will take your mind off of some of this. It's not good for you to concern yourself too much about these killings and beatings and burnings. The Negroes here ain't gonna do nothing about them. You should be having fun and enjoying yourself like others your age. Why don't you take piano lessons or something?
Yes, that's it,
I thought, still lying there. This year I'll take piano lessons. I'll join the band and play basketball again. I will keep busy from sunup to sundown. Then I won't have to think about the Taplins, Jerry, Emmett Till, or Benty. No, I won't even have to talk to Mama them or get uptight when Raymond stares at me all the time, because from now on, I'll spend as little time in this house as possible. Next summer, I will go back to Baton Rouge and get a job. And as soon as I finish high school, I am going to leave Centerville for good.
Chapter 13. That night, I lay in bed making plans for the whole year. Somehow, I thought of everything except Mrs. Burke and the job after school. And I didn't even think of her the next day until she happened by the house. Mama, Adeline, and the rest of the children were sitting on the porch when she drove up. I was in my room going through my old school clothes.
Essie Mae, Miss Burke here to see you,
Mama called to me.
Is Essie here?
I heard Mrs. Burke say.
I just stopped by to see when she was coming back.
Is Essie here? I thought, going to the porch. Why did she just happen by here today?
My, but you lost.